I will again ask for the blessings of all the Vaishnavas that I may speak the Bhagavatam's message properly. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Today we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 6, Chapter 3, entitled Yamaraj Instructs His Messengers, text number 11. Sri Badaraya Uvacha Iti Deva Sa Aprista Praja Samyamano Yamaha Pritasvadutan Pratyaha Smaran Padam Bhujam Hare. Translation. Srila Shukadeva Goswami said, "Thus having been questioned, Lord Yamaraj, the supreme controller of the living entities, was very pleased with his order carriers because of hearing from them the holy name of Narayan. He remembered the lotus feet of the Lord and began to reply." Please repeat. Sri Shukadeva Goswami said, by Srila Prabhupada. Srila Yamaraj, the supreme controller of the living entities in terms of their pious and impious activities, was very pleased with his servants because they had chanted the holy name of Narayan in his dominion. Yamaraj has to deal with men who are all sinful and who can hardly understand Narayan. Consequently, when his order carriers uttered the name of Narayana, he was extremely pleased, for he also is a Vaishnava. Sri Badaraya Uvacha Iti Deva Sa Aprishta Praja Samyamyamo Yamaha Prita Svadutan Pratyaha Smaran Padam Bhujam Hare. So now the Yamadutas have done good this time, although they don't even know what they did right at this point. Sometimes a child will say something and the parent will hear the child say something and become very pleased, although the child has no idea the significance of what they said. And so this is like that. The Yamadutas came before Yamaraj and they were in anxiety and they were suffering and they explained what happened. And in the course of doing so, they themselves uttered the name of Narayan. And just hearing that name, Yamaraj, it stimulated in him this smaran, this remembrance of the Lord. Hearing the name affected his mind. He remembered the Lord's lotus feet. And so that kind of remembrance is the best kind of remembrance. And so he was pleased with the Yamadutas. When we are fortunate enough to be reminded of the Lord, we should be thankful for that person or that thing that caused that remembrance in our mind. Because the mind is very fickle, as most of us all struggle trying to control the mind. Krishna says it's chanchalam, manas chanchalam astiram, that the mind is very flickering. It goes here and it goes there. And although the mind's natural position is to flow straight to the lotus feet of the Lord, due to our ignorance, it's always going other places, and we have a difficult time focusing it. So if something comes along and brings our mind to the lotus feet of the Lord, we should be very thankful. I just heard this announcement about yoga today at 9 o'clock, and I practice a little yoga myself. And a process for liberation that is all about controlling the mind. Because Krishna says the mind, that one should elevate oneself or deliver oneself with the help of the mind and never degrade oneself. And that the mind is the friend of the living entity, or it can also become the enemy of the living entity. So it's the mind that will deliver us, or the mind that will bind us. And so the different processes to attain liberation involve the control of the mind. And in the school of yoga, that's done through a very mechanical means. Right? We see people doing yoga asanas and they're twisting and stretching and balancing themselves in different ways. And there's a reason for that. And it all has to do with the mind. But the entire process is about controlling the mind. The yoga school is outlined in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. And there he defines what yoga is. First sutra says, ta yoga anushasanam, that now is the time. Just like in the Vedanta Sutras, now is the time. So now is the time to hear about yoga. And then he defines what yoga is. And he says, yogas chitta vritti nirodaha. That yoga is the nirodaha, the ending or the cessation of the chitta vritti. The vritti means the fluctuations in the chitta or in the consciousness. So the mind and the intelligence and the ego, they're fluctuating. He actually goes on to define what those fluctuations are, and they're five. And I won't go into all the details about that because I don't know it all so well. Yoga means to calm that because it's fluctuating. It doesn't mean to empty it, as some teachers will teach, but it actually means to calm it so that it's not fluctuating, so that it actually can be focused on one point. And that one-pointed concentration is called samadhi, and that's the goal. So to control the mind is the goal, focus it on one point. And then it goes on to say that when the fluctuations in the consciousness are calmed and they cease, and one has it focused on one point, then one, the seer or the self, experiences their own true nature, which is separate from the material body and the material mind and the material intelligence and the material ego. It stands separated from that. And then you experience something. You experience, I guess what you experience is aham brahmasmi, that I am spirit. I'm not the intelligence, I'm not the mind, I'm not the ego. And then it goes on to say that if one doesn't manage to calm down the cessations in the chitta and experience the self, then one identifies with the chitta vritti. One identifies with the fluctuations in the mind. So it's all about calming the mind. But it's a difficult process to do. And when people see people practicing these yoga asanas, they wonder, what does that have to do with the mind? But there is a connection. It's a very clear connection. And that is that the yogis have discovered that there's a connection between the breath and the mind. And then there's a connection again between the mind and the body. So it's through the breath that one calms the mind. And whether or not we are conscious of it, we all know that. Because just like if we become nervous or become anxious due to something, we find if we naturally we take a deep breath and we exhale, and then we become a little, the mind becomes a little bit calm and we can concentrate again. Even in japa, we can notice that if our mind wanders somewhere and we try to immediately bring it back, it's difficult. But if we take a breath, just like if you had this board here, you can erase this, you can write new things on it. So if you have something written on it and you don't like it, you don't immediately write on top of that, or you have a big mess. You clear it, and then you write what you want nicely right on top of it. So the mind is like that too. You take a deep breath, and you exhale, and in a sense you've cleared the mind. And then again you focus on the holy name. So when one breathes deeply, the mind becomes calmed. And these asanas are difficult to get into for most people. And the tendency is to try to force oneself into them. But actually what one is meant to discover through the practice is that when I relax the mind, then the body relaxes. And it's only then that I can nicely go into the asana. And actually in all of Patanjali Yoga Sutras, there's only one mention of asana. Right? When we think of yoga, we think of the asanas. But in the whole Yoga Sutra, it's all about the mind. And there's one mention of asana. That is sukham sthiram asanam, right? That the asana should be sukham. It should be, one should be happy or pleasant, not disturbed. And sthiram, one should be fixed that way. So one discovers that I take a deep breath, I relax. When I breathe deeply, I relax. And then when I go into the asana, then my not only my mind relaxes, but when my mind relaxes, then the tension in my body becomes released, and then I become capable of entering into the asana. And so it's been said that when the mind is quiet, then the asana is correct. This is how you know. It's not so much about how perfectly your body is aligned, but it's about how your mind is situated when you're in the asana. So when the mind is quiet, then the asana is correct. And that means that when that mind is quiet, then you can focus it. And so some yogis, when they practice asana, then they actually are chanting mantras with each asana. So when they go into the asana, there's a mantra to be chanted. And this is how you can know if when you're doing your asana, if you're doing it right, because your mind will be quiet. And how do you know that it's quiet? You can try chanting a mantra when you're in the asana. And if you can very clearly chant, you know, Chintamani Prakara Sadma Sukalpa Riksha, with ease, then you're doing it properly. And if you're struggling and suffering and, you know, that means that the mind's not peaceful and actually the asana's not been done correct. So what happens is in the course of practicing a series of asanas, the mind becomes more, you practice at each asana, you do an asana and you practice that with your breath. As you go into it, you calm the mind. Then you come out of that asana and you go into the next asana and again, you calm the mind. And then you come out of that and then you go into the next and again, you calm the mind. And it's this is like a drill. You all know the word drill, the English word drill. I mean, not just there's a tool called a drill, but there's another meaning, which means, just like in the army, they have what they call a drill sergeant. A drill is when they make you do something again and again and again and again and again until you get it, so you become expert at that. So you do it, actually it's through repetition that we become expert at something. So you do it again and again, you do this asana every day, many times, and you do that every day. So you're doing it hundreds of times in a day and thousands of times, and then hundreds of thousands of times, you're practicing calming the mind, calming the mind, calming the mind. Until you learn, you gain some control in how to calm your mind. And this is actually beneficial for a bhakta, because our process is meditational, that we want to learn to calm the mind and focus it on Krishna, because his tendency is to go so many places. So that's why the asanas help one to achieve the goal of yoga, which is to control the mind and focus on one point. And then when one has learned to calm the mind again like this again and again, then you move on to pranayama, which is like a more focused, you're focusing solely on the breath. And then up to the higher and higher, more subtle stages of meditation. It's a very difficult process. There's something that we can get from it. There's something that we can use from it that's beneficial. Of course, there's the health benefits, but also for meditation. So we can accept that and we can apply that. But achieving the goal of it, actually, when Prabhupada would speak about it, he would almost always be saying just that this process for this age is practically impossible. So difficult. There may be a few people that are achieving some samadhi through this Ashtanga yoga, but it's very, very difficult. One has to have quite some high qualification to do so. Our process is different. We also want to control the mind and control the senses. But our process is that we want to let Krishna into our mind and then let Krishna do that work. Here we see that Yamaraj has got this job that he has to do. It's a service for Krishna, for Lord Narayan. But it's a hard service because of the association that's involved. Having to deal with so many sinful people. It's a service, but externally it's not a very pleasant service. But then here was this one break in it where out of the most, from those he would never expect it from, these Yamadutas who are so fierce and frightening and ugly and tamasic in their way, that they just mentioned, by chance, they mentioned this name of Narayan, and it became pleasing to him. But we want Narayan in our consciousness always, right? The Lord Krishna in our mind. So our process is that we want the Lord to enter. We want to let the Lord enter somehow. We try to block it in so many ways because we're attracted to so many things. But our real goal is to allow Krishna to enter into our mind, and then he takes over. And there's a very beautiful verse, actually there's a very beautiful chapter, in the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. Actually, the first chapter of the Antya Lila is Rupa Goswami's second meeting with the Lord, which takes place in Puri at the Siddhabakul tree. And I guess most of you have probably just visited this holy place. You all go to Siddhabakul. I don't know how you fit all the people in there. This is a small place. It's a very wonderful place. So much happened there. And of course, Haridas Thakur resided there. And the Lord personally found that spot for him. And then Sanatana Goswami and Rupa Goswami also stayed there with him. So it's such a specially empowered spot. And that chapter it's full of beautiful verses because it goes on and on with verses from the Vidugda Madhava and the Lita Madhava. But there's a lot of very important instruction there. And what happens is that Sri Chaitanya goes to meet Rupa Goswami at the Siddhabakul tree. And he's writing his drama there. And Haridas Thakur is there as well. So the Lord says, "What is that you're writing?" And he takes the palm leaf and he looks at it. And his first reaction when he looks at that palm leaf is he sees the handwriting of Rupa Goswami. And just the handwriting of Rupa Goswami is so beautiful that he's very pleased. And he says that the handwriting of Rupa Goswami, it's just like a row of pearls. And then he reads the verse. And when he reads the verse, he becomes thrust into an ocean of spiritual ecstasy. And he reads it out loud, and then when Haridas Thakur hears it, he also becomes thrust into, he's drowning in this ocean of ecstasy, hearing this verse, and he's chanting, and he's dancing, and he's exhibiting all these symptoms of transcendental spiritual ecstasy. So the next day, the Lord brings his close associates. He brings Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, and he brings Swarup Damodar Goswami, and he brings Srila Ramananda Roy. And on the way to that place, he's praising Srila Rupa Goswami, who at that time is more like a junior devotee in that Sangha. And he's glorifying how great Rupa Goswami is and how his writing is unparalleled. And they arrive at the Siddhabakul, and they take a seat on an elevated platform. And then they invite Rupa Goswami and Haridas Thakur to sit there with them. But they're feeling unqualified to sit on that seat. And so they again are saying, "Please come and sit with us up here." And they're like, "No, no, no. Please, no. Please, no. Please, no." He refuses to sit there. They want to sit on a lower level. So they accept that. And then Sri Chaitanya says, "Rupa Goswami, please read to us that verse that you composed, that when one hears it, they become drowned in an ocean of ecstasy." And Rupa Goswami is feeling very shy amongst these senior Vaishnavas, and he doesn't feel like it would be proper for him to read his own composition. But Sri Chaitanya persists and says, "Please read this verse." And again, he says, he's refusing. Through repeated persistence, they finally convince him to read this verse. It's a very beautiful verse. And that verse is, "Tunde tundavali ritim vatanute, tundavali labdhaye, karna krodha kadambani gatayate, karne budebras priham, cheto pragyana sangani vijayate, sarvendriyana kritim, najane janita kriyadbiramritai, krishneti varna tvayi." That I do not know how much nectar the two syllables Krishna have produced. And when the syllables Krishna are chanted on the tongue, they dance on the tongue, and one wishes they had many, many mouths. And when the name Krishna enters into the ear, then one wishes they had many millions of ears. And when it enters into the courtyard of the heart, then the mind becomes, how does it say? The mind becomes stunned, and the senses become inert. So that right there is a description of yoga, right? That the senses and the mind come under control. But in our process, they come under control through the process of chanting the holy name. The name Krishna is chanted on the tongue, enters into the ear, and then it enters into the courtyard of the heart, And then it takes over, right? It's not that we have to control it. It actually controls us. We just have to accept it. We just have to bring the mind a little under control so that we let it in. And then it takes over. So when the other Vaishnavas hear this verse, they are also all suddenly drowning in an ocean of ecstasy. And Ramananda Roy is there. And of course, he's also a great writer of dramas. So he has a very refined taste. And of course, Swarup Damodar Goswami as well, because whenever some kind of drama was written, if it was going to be performed for the Lord, it would have to be brought to Swarup Damodar Goswami so he could check it. Because also his taste and his understanding of it was very, very refined. So they all had this very, very deep appreciation for this beautiful verse, for the beautiful way in which it was composed, and for also the meaning that was expressed in it. And so that's our kind of yoga. And when they heard it, they felt ecstasy. And when Sri Chaitanya heard it, he felt ecstasy. When Haridas Thakur heard it, he felt ecstasy. It became a stimulus for their transcendental emotions. And that term for that is called Udipana. Right? This is written about in the Nectar Devotion. That those items that become a stimulus for bhakti rasa to take place are called Udipana. There's so many types. Actually, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur composed a beautiful song called Radhakun Tata, which is basically a long list of all the Udipana, all the sights and the sounds in Braja. And of course, he lived by the bank of Radhakund. So the song describes so many things, the peacocks and the cows and the sounds that are there. And it goes on and on describing all of these sights and sounds that when one experiences them, they remind one of Krishna. And then the song ends by him saying, I will not live anywhere in the world where these Udipana are not present. Because then how will we remember? We'll forget. Because the mind is fickle. So we need that constant remembrance. And for weak devotees like myself, we make compromises and we say, we want Krishna in our mind, but it's so hard in the world that we're living in. So we'll allow a little of this and a little of that, but we won't go too far. We won't allow other certain things. But actually, if we're wise, we'll surround ourselves with this Krishna Udipana, these things that remind us of Krishna. And this way our mind will be constantly, repeatedly reminded of Krishna. And then we'll become purified. And gradually that Krishna will enter in the courtyard of our heart and transform us. I was remembering one time when I was with my Guru Maharaj, and I would be a servant for some time, and I would put him, when it was time for bed, I would put him to bed, in a sense. He would go to bed, and we'd have a little conversation. I'd say, may you have sweet dreams, and we'd have a little sweet conversation. And then I would leave, and he would go to sleep. So one time, I don't remember exactly what it was we were discussing, but somehow a jingle came. Do you all know the word jingle? Jingle means in advertising, when there's a little song to advertise some product. They call it a jingle. They're usually very silly, and they tend to annoy us because they get stuck in the brain, and we want to get it out. For some reason, this absurd jingle trying to sell us some product that we don't need is stuck inside our consciousness. So through our conversation, some jingle, the memory of some jingle from his childhood came up. When he was just a boy, like 5 years old, this jingle was still there. Deep underneath, it was still there. And he asked me, do I know this jingle? And I don't remember if I knew it or not. But and then he said, just see how unfortunate we are growing up in America. We have our mind from our childhood full of all this useless things. He said, but in India, what do they have? The children, they grow up and they have Sita Ram, Sita Ram. And we're stuck with these, we're stuck with all this trash in our consciousness. So, in this world, it's difficult for us to keep our consciousness fixed. But it's very important that we do. Right? It's a dangerous world. And we can look at it in different ways. If we're always remembering Krishna, then it's a very wonderful place. But when we forget Krishna, it becomes a very dark place, right? Because we're in that place where those who have wanted to enjoy separately from Krishna have come. And our only goal is to return to Krishna. And there's so much here that's meant to keep us here. And when we become attached to that, and then we become reminded that this isn't our home through so much suffering. And no one wants to have to endure that kind of suffering. So we have to be so vigilant to make sure that the mind remains our friend and not our enemy. That remembrance of Krishna, for that matter, any kind of remembrance, we're dependent on Krishna for. Sarvasya chaham hridisani vishto mata smrita gyanam apohanam cha. That Krishna says that I'm situated in everyone's heart. And from me come knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. So if we remember something, it's not that we do it by our own power. It's that Krishna allows us to remember it. He enables us to remember it. And when we're able to remember Krishna, that's what we have to pray for. That Krishna, please allow us to remember you. And so many, if we read Bhagavatam, throughout it, so many places we're going to find with the devotee prays to Krishna that no matter what I go through, all I want is that I may remember you. Right? And it's the remembrance of Krishna that saves so many. We see Gajendra, right? There he was in that very difficult circumstance that he's fighting for his life in the water with a crocodile biting down on his leg. So this is a circumstance of great suffering, and not only that, but he felt that he was becoming weaker. So if he was in a bad circumstance at that instance, it was about to get worse. And so he, due to the remembrance that was instilled in his consciousness from previous life, Krishna somehow in the heart said, here, remember this, right? And beautiful prayers to the Lord. So he chanted those prayers. So he was fortunate. He had used his mind in such a way in the previous life that he filled it with Krishna. And at the time when he most needed it, Krishna came back to him in the form of those prayers. And when he chanted them, Krishna came directly to him. And at that point, you can see that his consciousness was actually very good. Because normally one would say, please, Lord, get this crocodile off my leg. It would be the first request. But he wasn't even thinking like that. He was just glorifying the Lord. So Krishna allowed him to remember that. Krishna can also make us forget, apohanam cha. That's also there, that we can forget. And if we're not careful, and if we're not conscious, and if we're not begging for that, then Krishna will also allow us to forget his lotus feet. Right? Yamaraj is a great devotee, and he's sitting there in that, you know, sending those, you know, in a sense, in that courtroom of this universe, where remembrance of Krishna is not so common. So he was very grateful that Krishna arranged for his remembrance in the form of the Yamadutas coming to him and chanting the name of Narayan. So we need to do that kind of... We can't just sit around and hope that Yamaduta is going to come and say the name Narayan and that's going to remind us. We have to actually work at it and pray to Krishna and perform our sadhana in such a way that our mind becomes absorbed in all those impressions. Through hearing, through chanting and through hearing, become deeply impressed in our chitta, right? So that the only vritti that takes place in our chitta is Krishna vritti. That whatever moves in our consciousness is just thoughts of Krishna. And Prabhupada, he made the sacrifice so that can take place. And it's through all of his books. Right? So much time and so much effort was given so that we could hear and chant the glories of the Lord. Especially, you all grew up here, to some degree, you're more fortunate that the message of Krishna was here for you. For those of us that grew up in other places, we would have never have even heard it. Maybe in some academic setting, we would have heard some mention of the Bhagavad Gita. But other than that, we would have had no access. Nobody brought it. Even all these yoga teachers, even all these so-called gurus, they didn't bring that. It's a fact. Actually, when they go to the West, mostly what they describe is psychology more than anything. They talk about psychology. They don't give the glories of the Lord. They don't give that medicine that allows the Lord to enter into our heart and change our consciousness. So Prabhupada did that. And he did it while doing so many other things. He performed the tapas of rising so early in the morning and dedicating hours of his day to composing all those books that we sing. So it's through Shravanam and Kirtanam that we get smarter, that remembrance comes. Right? Otherwise, we have no access to that. That memory won't come. The mind will just be full of so many other memories. So we have to, just as Yamaraj was feeling grateful to the Yamadutas, that just by chance they mentioned the name of Lord Narayan, not even with the intention of glorifying Narayan, with the intention of complaining about the circumstances which they were in, that name was chanted. He felt grateful, he felt happiness, he felt pleased by the Yamadutas. So how grateful we must be to Srila Prabhupada. Right? And of course, he's the one in his Bhagavad Gita that, through his Bhagavad Gita, he teaches us Yam Yam Vapi Smaram, again, Bhavan, Jajayante Kalevram, Tam Tam Evaiti Kaunteya, Saratad Bhava Bhavataha. That Yam Yam Vapi Smaram, again, remembering what we remember at the Ante, at the end, that determines our next birth, where we go. So, therefore, Tasmat Sarveshu Kaleshu, Mam Anusmara Yudhyacha. So, therefore, always remembering me. Even if you're fighting, Yudhyacha, right? Mam Anusmara Yudhyacha. Even while fighting, remember me. That's our goal. If we look at the Bhagavad Gita, we see that there's 18 chapters and they're divided in sections of 6. And in the middle, that's protected by the outside chapters, it's said, because that's the most confidential part. And if you go to the very middle of the middle, the last, because right in the middle would be between the 9th and the 10th chapters. Right there we find the very last verse of the 9th chapter is Manmana. See, I'm forgetting. Manmana bhava madbhakto madhyaji mama namaskru. Always think of me. Always remember me. And through that, we become his devotee and surrender unto the Lord. So that's the most confidential message in the Bhagavad Gita. Always remember Krishna. That's our goal, and that's our process of purification. It's the means, and it's the end. So with that, I will end. And I'll ask all of you to please give some comment, or if you have some question.
Thank you, Prabhu, for a nice class. I had this question regarding yoga. Now, since we are already practicing one form of yoga, that is chanting of the holy names, and relying on that to control our mind. So the reason why we do this other yoga is mainly for health benefits.
Right.
So is that is the mood in which we are doing this. So you would like to throw some light upon how a practicing devotee, how does he approach this yoga practice?
Yeah. The health benefit is a very good one. And for all of you who are practicing with that intention, that's Krishna Seva, because it's to maintain the body in such a way that one can continue to serve Krishna nicely. And that's important. But while you're doing it, why not reap as much benefit as possible? Right? So there's two reasons why the asana is done. One is bodily, and one is on the level of the mind. How it affects the body, how it affects the mind. So there's two things it does for the body. One is it generally gives a good health, which is important. And actually, the more one does it, the more one can see just how brilliant it is. Right? Whoever invented this system of asanas, They had very deep, obviously some, Krishna gave them deep insight about how the body works, subtly, so that by performing these asanas, actually gets so much benefit, health-wise. But the other benefit it does for the body is it just gives one the ability to sit up straight. Because if one can't sit straight for a long time, then one's going to have a difficult time meditating. Right? It becomes, even in japa, we see if the body becomes weak and then it starts to slump, and then Prabhupada would say, sit properly. Right? Because when we're sitting properly, then why does Prabhupada say sit properly? Right? All the we have that tape, right, of Prabhupada chanting. The only instruction he gives is sit properly. So, because when one sits properly, so this is one thing I've noticed, because I've been given the service to enter into the world of people performing yoga. And for the most, I don't want to criticize, but for the most part, we find that these people don't have a lot of spiritual insight, at least in the world that I'm entering into. Although they have curiosity and they may be doing some kind of practice and they think they're much more advanced than they are often. But what I have noticed is that some of the external things that we tend to take for granted, because we do have a higher and more potent process, we sometimes we don't give so much importance to some of the details that they find important. But one is sitting properly. And when one sits properly, then one can also control the mind. So through the asanas, in many ways, in one sense, the muscles are developed in such a way that the back becomes straight. And also internally, there are certain locks in the body that allow the better control of the breath, that the breath has a more purifying effect on the subtle body. So the asanas help us do both of those as far as bodily things are concerned. But why not use those asanas to help us learn to control the mind? Because this is what I've discovered, in any case, that, again, to enter into these asanas, the tendency is to want to pull oneself into them, force oneself into them. And that's actually, often people get hurt that way. They actually hurt their bodies that way. But if the teacher is good, they'll teach you that it's done, that one enters into those asanas through relaxing through the breath, right? Relaxing the mind through the breath, and then when the mind becomes relaxed, the body relaxes, and one can go deeper. And it's right there, in that relaxed state of mind. If we can enter into that asana in a relaxed state of mind, then we could chant that mantra, and we're doing it right. So why not learn to control the mind if we're doing that kind of practice? Because again, it's a drill. You do it again and again and again and again and again with the intention of relaxing the mind, making the mind peaceful. If we do that faithfully, you know, regularly, it will give us some ability, and that will help us particularly in japa. I remember once, because I used to distribute books daily, and you are forced to experience so many things that can disturb one's mind in that service, right? People come and they say things to you. Beyond tolerating external circumstance, people say things to you that are designed to disturb your mind. And so the yoga that's practiced there is actually calming the mind. And I remember one devotee said to me, if you find that your mind becomes disturbed, then step back, take a deep breath, and chant. And he would chant some verse from the Brahma Samhita. He said, and then you'll feel your entire consciousness purified, and then begin again, right? So, especially in japa, but actually in so many circumstances, we have to control the mind, but particularly in japa, that just like we do an asana, and we clear the mind and we enter it peacefully, then again we clear the mind and enter the next one peacefully. Just like with each bead, it helped me understand the importance of the beads to some degree. That we take a bead in our fingers, and on that bead, we chant a mantra. And then the mind is cleared, and we go on to the next bead. And we chant on that bead. We place gently, consciously, with in a very conscious way, we delicately place that mantra on the bead again. Then again. So rather than just zipping through, and those beads are just zipping through our hand, and sometimes we drop the mala, and when we know when we drop it, we think it always happens when we're completely, our mind is somewhere else. I don't know if we've all experienced that. If our mind is, if you ever drop your mala when you're chanting, then you stop and think, where was my mind? You know, it's always when you're, it's never when your concentration was clear, it's always when you're really somewhere else. So with each bead, one very consciously places a mantra. We can learn a little bit of how to do that through this yoga process. It can help us concentrate like that, I find. Nityananda Prabhu.
Like, we are performing bhakti yoga. So the whole process is depending on Krishna, and So is it that this external process will make us kind of depending on other things other than Krishna?
Yeah. It can. One has to guard against that. Actually, in one sense, our whole process is dependent on Krishna, but the other side of that is it's dependent on our effort, right? So we say these two things, that it's the endeavor, but ultimately that the meaning of that endeavor is that it attracts the mercy of Krishna. So it's not by our endeavor that we attain Krishna bhakti, but our endeavor is important. So in any kind of external thing, we have to be careful that we don't lose sight of the significance of our practice and begin to see it on an equal level with others, although that sounds sectarian. But the fact is, we have to understand the potency of the holy name, that there's nothing like it because it is Krishna. Right? Just like this Gopal Chakravarti couldn't understand. He had other practices he was doing, I'm sure. And when he analyzed the potency of the holy name, Haridas Thakur said that simply Nama Bas can grant one mukti. That's not the goal. Even the impure chanting of the holy name can grant one that. And for Gopal Chakravarti to hear that, because he's involved in these other practices that require so much effort, lifetimes of effort to achieve liberation, for him to say that the holy name can do that for you, he's thinking this is ridiculous. And he has the audacity to make this insult to Haridas Thakur. So we have to be careful that we don't begin to think that, yes, there are all these processes and they're all the same. And one of the problems with these other processes is that, and it's a great, great trap, is that because they involve so much of one's own personal effort, that when one advances them, one thinks, I'm great because I've conquered the mind. So one begins to think, I'm great, I'm powerful. So that danger is there. We should be careful that we're always doing it in the service of Krishna. And even when we're doing those asanas, we're thinking of Krishna. Is that okay? Atul Krishna Prabhu. Oh, microphone.
Hare Krishna. We were just studying in the fifth chapter of the first canto about Sri Narad Muni, how he learnt the techniques of meditation from the Bhaktivedantas and applied those techniques, and he was able to get darshan of the Lord in the heart. And then the Lord disappeared from his darshan, and Prabhupada, and then he tried again. He tried again using the same techniques.
Yeah.
And yet, however, he was unable to visualize the Lord. And Prabhupada comments that, you know, no amount of mechanical process is actually sufficient to capture the Lord, but it ultimately relies upon His mercy. So I think that's a special component of the bhakti process that we have to take shoulder of, the mercy of the Lord.
Yes.
However, I have a question, and that is, I mean, you mentioned sit properly, that quote of Prabhupada, and also Prabhupada mentioned in the fourth canto, in a purport in the fourth canto, that if one sits properly with the soles of his feet, he says, Prabhupada says, the soles of his feet touching his thighs.
Yes.
then it's easy for him to meditate on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So there he's obviously indicating the benefits of sitting properly. Is there in your...
Suddenly everyone's shifting a little bit, but go ahead.
In your experience of this field, have you found any of our acharyas or any of in history of Vaishnavism where Vaishnavas have been, you know, using these techniques to enhance their dhyana, Krishna dhyana?
Yeah. Well, Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote a book called Prema Pradeep. Have you read it? It's a very thin book. It's interesting. Actually, Satyaraj Prabhu has a journal, scholarly journal, that I think comes out twice a year or so, the Journal of Vaishnava Studies, which are academic essays on different on Vaishnavism. And each issue he publishes has a different theme. And recently he published one on yoga and Vaishnavism. So there you find what Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur said about yoga, what Bhaktivinoda Thakur said about yoga, what some other Vaishnava lineages said about yoga. Interesting. And then what some yoga lineages said about Vaishnavism. Mostly what you get is warnings about it, the problems with it. Yeah. Like in the Prema Pradeep, it's actually a novel that discusses some Bengali men who are into, in Bengal in the early part of the last century, there was a group, started with a B, Brahmo Samaj. So it was three men from the Brahmo Samaj. They go to Vrindavan and describes experiences that they have. And there's also one person living in Vrindavan. He's a bhakta, but he came to bhakti through Ashtanga Yoga. And they're all questioning one great sadhu who's the authority of, and when he speaks, his word is accepted. And this yogi begins to express how he was practicing bhakti, but it was having no effect on him until he practiced yoga and gained control of his mind. And then he developed some taste for bhakti. And then that sadhu warns him that, yes, you are rare. It's good that you came to it this way, but most people aren't going to come through it that way. And then he gives the warnings. But it's interesting because most of the warnings you get, whether from Bhaktivinoda Thakur or from Srila Vishnuvanatha Chakravarti Thakur, they warn that if you develop siddhis, yogic siddhis, then they can draw you away from bhakti, which isn't going to be the problem for most of us, I don't think. So they say good things and they say bad things about it. More often there's a warning about the difficulties with that path. But there certainly is something to be gained. And there's another Vaishnava, a Sri Vaishnava, by the name of Krishnamacharya, you may be familiar with. Yeah. And it's through him that many of the modern yoga lineages come through. And he wrote a book called The Yoga Rahasya, which is, he says it was revealed to him the teachings of Yamunacharya. No, not Yamunacharya. Not the Muni. Here's our expert on the Sampradaya. Yes. Have you read The Yoga Rahasya? Have you? Okay. Is it a popular book in that Sampradaya? You've heard about it. About what? And how it was revived in some way? Okay. I would be very interested to hear all that you have to reveal about these things.
He was a...
Natamuni.
Yeah. So after this period of Alvars, which were like hundreds of years before, when it stopped, Natamuni came to revive the whole Sri Sampradaya.
Okay.
So his name is Natamuni because he is also very expert in Ashtanga Yoga.
So Nata means...
The Supreme Lord.
Okay, so why does it have anything to do with...
So Muni, Muni generally, they are like meditation, okay, like that. So Nata Muni.
Right.
So he was very expert in Ashtanga Yoga.
Uh-huh.
And he had two sets of disciples, some of them learning Ashtanga Yoga from him, and others are learning Divya Prabandham, that's like devotional songs of all words from him. These two sects were coming down. So and then Nathamuni's grandson is Jamunacharya.
Yes.
So Nathamuni told two sets of his disciples that you give this Alvar songs to Jamunacharya, and also he told other disciples you give the Ashtanga Yoga to Jamunacharya.
Okay.
So then Jamunacharya was growing up, then he became a king, as we know the story.
Yes.
Then he again came back to devotional service. So then the disciple of Nathamuni told Jamunacharya that if you come on this particular day, I was instructed by my guru to give this yoga to you, so please come. So then Jamunacharya was waiting on that particular day, but he was so busy in preaching and all these things, he forgot that he remembered on that particular day. Then he was lamenting that if he would have got this Pushpak Vimana, I would have gone right now and learned this yoga from this person. But then he could not go. So in this way, the yoga process kind of stops. In
I sense. See.
But then Nathamuni has written a book called Yoga Rahasya. And that has been coming down, like, at least, it's not so much in the Sampradaya, but somewhere in the remote, somebody is practicing like that. But then when Nathamuni also, when he was preaching this Ashtanga Yoga, when he was about to leave the body, he didn't take that process to leave the body, because he can sit in samadhi and he can visualize the Lord.
He used that process.
Yeah, but he didn't use that process to leave the body.
Uh-huh.
Rather, when he was in the house, one monkey and two hunters and his wife, they came. So then they came and they told him, we are looking for Nathamuni, where is he? So then they say, no, he's not here, he's somewhere else. So then Nathamuni came and they informed that then two hunters came, and one lady also, wife of the hunter also came, and monkey also came. So then Nathamuni became in ecstasy. My God, it is Lakshman, Ram, Sita and Hanuman. So I missed him and started running the forest and trying to search them, and this way he just leaves the body on the ground. So he also causes that the process for us to go back to Godhead, though he is well versed in Ashtanga Yoga, who is on the platform of Samadhi, he didn't take to that process. And the second, when he was about to leave the body and he was telling his disciples, those who are learning the Alvar songs, that you would like to have this Ashtanga Yoga, I can give to you. But then this disciple who became the Sampradaya link for the Sri Sampradaya, he said that, my dear Nathamuni, I would have easily taken Ashtanga Yoga from you, but my problem is that I am seeing dead body around me, and how can I get married?
I am seeing
dead bodies around me.
Okay.
So how can I get married? So then Nathamuni asked, what are you telling about? Then he says, I am seeing dead body means inauspicious place, and marriage is like, you know, very enjoyable thing. So he says, the people around me are suffering so hard, and you want me to learn Ashtanga Yoga, and in that samadhi I can have relation with the Lord and myself. So that is like getting married to the Lord, like, you know, you are just enjoying the Lord through your own, you know, Ashtanga Yoga process, but people are suffering. So I rather prefer this Alvar songs or this bhakti line from you rather than this Ashtanga Yoga, which is like selfish.
Uh-huh.
So in this way he rejects, and Nathamuni becomes so happy and embraces him, and he becomes the guru of Jamunacharya in that line. So in this
very
way, Rama Mishra, in this way, the yoga kind of, which was practiced previously even by devotees, slowly got, you know,
yeah,
sidetracked, and very few things were started coming.
Very interesting.
History of yoga in Sri.
You're revealing so much to me today. These are all, I should learn where you learned this from, and I should know this myself. We'll talk later. But in any case, I should wrap up. But this one, Krishnamacharya, comes from the family lineage of Yamunacharya. And he says that he had one experience. I forget where he went. I don't know if he went to Srirangam. He went somewhere. And he had some revelation of Nathamuni's Yoga Rahasya. And he recorded it. This is a very nice book. He's always, you know, I was reading it for the first time, and he was going on glorifying Lord Vishnu. One should be thinking of Lord Vishnu only when one's doing asanas and so many things. And I was waiting for something to get messed up here, you know. And then he said, one may ask the question, who is greater, Brahma, Shiva, or Vishnu? And I was waiting to turn the page, and I was going to say, they're all the same or something like that. You know, I thought something was going to go wrong, because that's what happens in all these yoga books. And I turned the page and it said, it is Vishnu. Clearly, that, you know, it's a, it was a very, some of the chapters read like straight out of the Bhagavatam's descriptions of the movements of the living entity and so on. There's nice yoga instruction, but it's always focused on Lord Vishnu. So I've seen some things like that, not so much. Okay. So I'm sorry for going too long. Grantaraj, Srimad Bhagavatam, Ki, Jaya. Thank you very much.